Today's topic is entrepreneurship, and it's the fourth of five podcasts on that topic. All five podcasts are going to revolve around the question of how entrepreneurship impacts the economy. And the focus of this lecture is the paper Muppets and Gazelles, Political and Methodological Biases in Entrepreneurship Research by Paul Nightingale and Alex Code. In the first podcast in the series, I basically rehashed the Schumpeterian argument that entrepreneurship is important to economic development. At the very minimum, you might accept that both incumbent firms, even the monopolistic ones, and entrepreneurs both have a role to play in innovation. We can debate which role, but surely both have a role. And because innovation is the primary cause of why the world is richer today than ever before in human history, to put it bluntly, you ought to care about both incumbent innovation and innovation by entrepreneurs. And the latter is, of course, what we're dealing with in this particular series. Now, there is, as Nightingale and Code make clear, an almost universally held belief that entrepreneurship is economically productive. We live very much in the century of Schumpeter, and Schumpeter's biography, written by Thomas McGraw, is called Prophet of Innovation, and his portrayal of entrepreneurs, that is, Schumpeter's portrayal of entrepreneurs, thoroughly shapes popular conceptions. You'll be pretty hard-pressed to find a politician in the Western world who does not support entrepreneurship-promoting policies in some way, and you'd be even harder-pressed to find a university that doesn't offer some entrepreneurship-supporting hub or some dedicated courses on that subject. And while you might shake your head at eighth graders having entrepreneurship days in school, there aren't many who would actively say that that's just a downright stupid idea. And as Nightingale and Code write, and I quote, "This belief in entrepreneurship as a potential solution to unemployment, economic growth, regional development, and innovation leads to substantial levels of public support." Looking at UK data, Story estimates that the annual total financial support for small business is equivalent to a public expenditure of 7.9 billion British pounds. And to contextualize that expenditure, each year the UK spends more taxpayers' money on small business than it spends on the police force or universities at 7 billion British pounds each. End quote. Now, there are various ways to be cynical about this, of course. You might say that it's all just hype and fashion. That's an issue we'll return to in the next episode. Or you might say that it's all just neoliberalism, which it also partly is. But really, there are good statistical reasons for thinking that this is so. Or to be more precise, the nature of new business creation is such that the kinds of statistical measures that we tend to care about are systematically inflated in a positive direction. In other words, if you're not careful, the unreflexive use of statistics will tend to affirm that pro-entrepreneurship view and do very little to challenge it. Were you to use the statistics more soundly, Nightingale and Code would argue, the image you'd get of entrepreneurship's importance would be very much more muddled than it tends to be. If you took that kind of more considered approach, they suggest, you'd see that, and I quote, the evidence for positive impact is at best weak and highly skewed by atypical firms. Even taking into account these atypical firms, new small firm jobs are more volatile, less productive, and less well paid, have fewer benefits, and have higher rates of accidents. Entrepreneurial firms are less innovative, less productive, and do not seem to be associated with gross domestic product growth. While self-employed individuals are happier and startups contribute to job creation in their first year, that impact is positive by construction, and it does not follow that more market entry should be encouraged or that more new firms will generate new jobs. End of quote. And by implication, I quote again, there may well be excessive entrepreneurship, if public policy encourages market entry to the point that that markets become thin, the profits of higher quality firms are reduced, so their growth is constrained, and a market for lemons is created for investors. End of quote. And that certainly is not the kind of policy recommendations that you most typically hear. The policy recommendations that you do typically hear have come, if we disregard the statistical part of the story, to prominence following a bit of an intellectual sea change that happened in the 1970s. Nightingale and Code claim that the ascendancy of entrepreneurship as a policy and field of research owes much to the work of Austrian economics, the same kind of Austrian economics that we've been talking a lot about on this course. As a little bit of background for this, which they cover, in the first half of the 20th century, Austria just had an incredibly bad run. The Austro-Hungarian Empire collapsed, there was World War I, there was the Great Depression, total economic devastation, a civil war, a government coup, and the German invasion during World War II. Now that was just a terrible, terrible set of events. And of course, produced all kinds of desire to explain however this could have happened. Now, Austrian economics emerged as an alternative explanation for these developments and emphasized the limits of centralized planning and played up the importance of emergent economic order and with it, the entrepreneur. The entrepreneur being, in their view, kind of the agent of emergence in the economic order. During World War II, many Austrian economics left Austria for good reasons and went to English-speaking countries, most famously Hayek going to the London School of Economics, where he began to sort of spar with Keynes. That's the Keynes of Keynesian economics, interventionist government, and counter-cyclical spending. And what they were sparring about was the appropriate macroeconomic policy, the way to think about the role of government in the economy. Now, after that, Austrian economics gets some intellectual traction in the Chicago School of Economics and informs a lot of what gets called, especially by its critics, neoliberalism. The most famous academic figure, loved and hated, out of that line of thinking is Milton Friedman, the kind of political figures that you might associate with the political implementation of these ideas are Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher in the 70s and 80s. Thatcher famously carried around a book by Friedrich Hayek and supposedly once banged it on the table during a policy meeting and said, "This is what we believe." So she certainly took academic theory, or at least the theory that she liked, more seriously than lots of contemporary politicians. Now, I just want to interject something here before we move on with Code and Nightingale's story, because this is obviously a critique of some of the ideas that underpin what I've been talking about. I think there are two ways to read Austrian economics. There's the macro version of it that I think underappreciates the role of the state in enabling entrepreneurship to actually occur in meaningful ways. And it romanticizes the extent of emergent entrepreneurship's contribution to the economy and, now venturing somewhat outside my area of expertise, has in the past decades just gone way overboard in its interpretation of, for instance, Hayek, promoting a sometimes political argument. And then there's a microversion, which examines how knowledge is distributed in society, which is what you've met in Shane and Kirchner's ideas of price and equilibrium, and the difficulties of coordinating, which you've heard play through a lot of my interpretations. And you can probably interpret from that that I'm much more convinced by the microversion than by the macroversion. And I think it's worth distinguishing. You don't have to take the whole package, I think. So anyway, returning to the central issue of this paper, the ascendancy of these ideas through the 80s and up to today creates a demand for knowledge about entrepreneurship. When there's lots of politicians advocating for it, there's naturally a demand for finding out what does entrepreneurship actually do to the economy, and there's also going to be a supply of researchers trying to contribute to those policy discussions in one way or another. So there's sort of a desire to create knowledge about entrepreneurship. Now, the problem is, of course, that good knowledge about entrepreneurship's macro-level consequences, it turns out, is really hard to get. So this plays out in lots of different ways, right? Measuring entrepreneurship is just very difficult. For one, data quality is sort of bad, almost by design. Small firms don't report as much data to statistical agencies as large firms do. And when a firm dies, it stops reporting. And since it's the poorly performing firms that tend to die, poor performance doesn't get measured very well in standard administrative statistics, the kind of data that policy often relies upon. For that reason, like, a lot of what we know about entrepreneurship actually comes from cases that aren't representative of the general population. Right, so Shane's study of 3D printing ventures doesn't say very much about the dynamics of less than high-tech companies that have nothing to do with MIT, with which they tend to be confounded in administrative data, right? Third, the definitions of entrepreneurship are really inconsistent and they slip around. The Europe and the US use very different definitions, for instance. And research just sort of defines the entrepreneur in all kinds of ways. If you compare Kirchner and Gantz et al., both readings are talking about entrepreneurship, but they operationalize that in totally different ways. And that's not very uncommon. We also tend to say that small firms are entrepreneurs, but most small firms, if you look at registered businesses, are old. So they're not what we tend to think about when we think about entrepreneurs. They're just companies that have reached a stable, small size. They're entrepreneurs that failed to grow or maybe didn't want to grow. Fourth, performance tends to regress to the mean. That means that if a new venture grows fast and subsequently shrinks, and that would be sort of an example of regression to the mean, it becomes first a highly successful entrepreneur, and then it becomes an unsuccessful large firm. And that's sort of worth dwelling about, right? We, by design, we hear more about the successful entrepreneurs. And that sort of bias sort of systematically favors small firms because you can't shrink when you haven't grown yet. And finally, and this is perhaps the least appreciated, is that entrepreneurial outcomes are just incredibly skewed. It's worth dwelling on that skew just for a little bit. Entrepreneurial outcomes we know now, we haven't always known this, are highly skewed and are in fact distributed according to a Pareto distribution or power law distribution. And in that kind of distribution, the vast majority of firms just do really poorly and have very small, minority at the very right-hand tail pulls up the average so much. So much so that if you remove a few of the successful firms, your analysis will just typically change very dramatically. When that's the case, averages don't make a lot of sense for describing the distribution because unlike a Gaussian normal distribution, the results don't fall uniformly around an average. It's also not clear that it's even sensible to talk about firms in that distribution as being of the same kind because the differences in their outcomes is so fundamentally different, so of such fundamentally different degree, that it becomes a difference in kind. The really successful restaurant on the corner is, relative to a really successful, rapidly growing high-tech firm, just fundamentally not the same kind of success. In a Pareto distribution, that really successful restaurant is much closer to a failed tech startup than to an even moderately successful high-tech one. These problems of measurement create two interesting patterns. For one, looking over time, you see a trend towards less positive appraisals of the entrepreneur and of entrepreneurship, reflecting, sort of funnily enough, Schumpeter's personal transition in perspective. Second, as research is translated into policy, it becomes increasingly positive. As such, even today, you get really pro-entrepreneurship policies based on interpretations of research findings that are somewhat lukewarm on the topic. And you can see this just across discussions of job creation, productivity growth, innovation, contributions to economic growth, etc. Now, you do see, for instance, that new firms create jobs and do so at a far faster rate than old firms. But that is sort of totally expectable when you think about it. New firms can't create a negative amount of jobs, right? You cannot have less than zero employees. But old firms that are large can have a negative growth in employment, right? Also, lots of the jobs that new firms create simply compensate for the ones that are lost by other small firms closing down, right? Small firms close down very often, much more so than large ones. And a lot of those jobs just get taken over by new small firms. In that way, the sort of jobs that small firms create are much more a result of churn in the economy than actual growth. Moreover, the jobs created in small firms tend to be just less productive, they tend to pay less, they tend to have more accidents. Small firms as a whole are also less productive than large ones, and the differences, again, are really highly skewed. It turns out that it takes a really long time for new entrepreneurs to reach the productivity levels of established firms, and many just never do so. So the idea that startups, on the whole, are super productive, efficient, and nimble, while established firms are slow and lumbering, is just plainly wrong. Similarly, it's also plainly wrong that startups are innovative. As Nightingale and Code say, so few startups are innovative that any innovative startups are atypical. Because perhaps we're comparing small firms never meant to grow or innovate, i.e. the pizzeria on the corner, with ones meant to grow and innovate, like a biotech company doing vaccine-related R&D. But also, like, when you just think about it, most startups just don't have the resources to conduct very capital-intensive, very explorative R&D work in the same way that incumbents can, because incumbents can diversify away the risk by having a portfolio of projects, whereas most startups cannot. They have to commit. And in that way, you can think about, or you can at least question, why we would expect small firms to be able to invest in really high-risk projects. The image that we get of entrepreneurs creating brilliant new technologies, by and large, a feature of what a few very visible industries are doing, and in those industries, very specific conditions tend to apply. You might, for instance, start a dot-com company worth billions in your parents' basement, but it's just very unlikely to see somebody hacking together a pharmaceutical company in their parents' garage, right? In this way, when you think about the firms being less productive and less innovative, it's also hardly surprising that small firms as a whole don't make their founders a lot of money. Rather, it seems that both founders and workers in small firms actually enjoy working there more. You can think about that as just being your own boss, or at least knowing your boss, if in the case of workers, can just be rewarding in all kinds of ways. It's just probably not rewarding in the financial way. There is, however, also evidence that Nightingale and Code don't review to suggest that being an entrepreneur is associated with a greater occurrence of mental illness, anxiety, and divorce. So I'd maybe take the image of joyful self-employment with somewhat more of a pinch of salt than they do. People may like being their own boss in a successful firm, but being your own boss in a failing firm, worrying about how to make payroll, how to pay rent, support your family, probably not so great. It's also not surprising that small firms don't make a big dent in economic growth statistics, right? If they don't generally innovate, don't generally have great productivity, how could they? Some do make a dent, of course, by both innovating and being efficient, and making products that let others be more efficient, but certainly not all. And those that do make this dent are often, not always, but often, ones that spin out from large firms or draw on publicly available results of funded research. The sort of disruptive innovations that Christensen writes about, for instance, were by and large rejected ideas developed in incumbent firms. If you look at a company like Google, the core idea was developed during the founder's publicly funded doctoral studies. And you'll see similar dynamics in the self-driving car industry, for instance. That basically came out of a competition funded by the DARPA agency, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency in the US. Thoroughly public money. So now it's not so much the entrepreneurs being innovative and just driving this big impact, but rather leveraging things that exist already and just commercializing them. And thus, sort of disabused of any romanticism that we might have had about entrepreneurship, what are we to do? I'm going to quote a little extensively to summarize. Begin quote. It certainly is the case that a small number of startups has a positive impact on the economy. But most of the time, for most of the firms, and for most of the performance metrics, the economic impact of entrepreneurial firms is poor. End of quote. What that means for Nightingale and Code is that we need to accept these highly skewed outcomes and revisit how we actually conceptualize entrepreneurship. They say, and I quote, analytical precision would be improved by dividing this category into at least two subcategories that could be positioned along a performance continuum from high-impact firms, or gazelles, at one end, to poorly performing firms at the other. We refer to these poorer performing firms as marginal, undersized, poor performance enterprises, or Muppets, with the category intended to capture the median small business. Their firms are marginal because they lack the ambition or capabilities to grow or innovate, have high death rates, and are poorly captured in statistics or academic studies. They're undersized because they lack the minimum efficient scale needed to perform on par with incumbents in their sectors and industries. And as a result, they are poor performance. They have low productivity and low levels of innovation and generate churn rather than economic growth. And these Muppets, just to be crystal clear on that, are far more typical than gazelles. The median firm is a Muppet. It's worth quoting them at length just once more about the conceptual implications of this distinction. While this recategorization fits the empirical evidence, it is at odds with the dominant Austrian theoretical position in the entrepreneurship literature, which often ascribes the properties of gazelles to the average market entrants. For instance, Kurtzner's stylized vision of entrepreneurial opportunity recognition holds that entrepreneurial discovery involves the surprise that accompanies the realization that one has overlooked something, in fact, readily available. This is difficult to reconcile with the fact that most entrepreneurial entry decisions turn out to be mistakes and are followed by rapid exit. End of quote. What the evidence shows, at least if we treat entrepreneurship as being synonymous with new firms, is that most entrepreneurs don't perceive opportunities very accurately. Kurtzner would probably, reasonably enough, say that he doesn't care about whether the kind of entrepreneurship that he's talking about is organized in an independent new firm or done by an enterprising manager or worker within a corporate context. And that what's interesting is less firm formation and more the entrepreneurial function. But that, of course, just shows how totally murky it is to actually understand this phenomenon. The policy implication of Code and Nightingale's analysis, and indeed the implication for you, listener, if you're considering entrepreneurship in your career, is to reconsider the hierarchy of employment, self-employment, and employer. If you look at Table 1 on page 133 of their paper, really what we'd be interested in is not entrepreneurship in itself, but the white boxes in the table, where they transition into more productive and more innovative categories. Code and Nightingale write of the framework. Within this hierarchy, moving from being an employee to self-employment, which is traditionally seen as an improvement, is instead a deterioration. The move may simply correspond to employees with resources semi-retiring, which may make them happier but is likely to reduce income and productivity. Similarly, it helps show why high numbers of self-employed individuals are not associated with economic development, as they are lower down the hierarchy, just above unemployed. Now, for the budding entrepreneur in the audience, it should be a somewhat sobering reminder that leaving a corporate job for an entrepreneurial venture is, by and large, a really bad idea most of the time. Taking the leap is not likely to get you to the other side of the chasm. It's going to take you to the bottom of the chasm. Chances are that your venture will too will end up as a Muppet on the left side of the outcome distribution. And if you're sure that it won't, be reminded that entrepreneurs are prone to overconfidence and that everyone else in that left-hand side of the distribution probably thought that they too belonged much further to the right.